All right, everybody. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, whenever, however you're listening. Welcome back. Hopefully you enjoyed yesterday's show. My camera is just a little bit off center. Oh man, that would drive me nuts. I see we already have a lively crowd. Yes, if you came here for specifically that, then you are definitely going to hear some tonight. I don't know. I'm just messing with you guys. But anyways, you guys might have heard me over the last probably like 6 months to maybe a year, where I don't want to necessarily say I've been super down on libertarianism, but I've kind of pivoted over. I shouldn't say pivoted over, but kind of exploring that a little bit more. And I'm sure my guests and I today will talk about that, but also kind of some of the stuff that's been going on in the dissident right and libertarian spheres, which is mainly where I occupy. And then, frequently talk to left-wing activists and left-wing anti-war people as well. But this is kind of my main stomping grounds, if you will. So, real excited for today's show. I just randomly got thrown into a group chat with my guest today, and someone had recommended that I have him on, and I'm really, really excited for this anyway. So, before we get into today's show, please go to all the links below to figure out where you can find me, my guest, everything he's got going on, everything I've got going on. As always, Tiger Fitness through links below. As you can see, I got all the pre-workouts, branched-chain amino acids, protein powders right there behind me. You can get all that stuff from tigerfitness.com. Use code Kyle at checkout to let them know that I sent you there and that you support the Matovic family. Fox and Sons through the link below, same deal, Kyle at checkout, and Deemed Fit through the link below. The code SARAM25. But with all that stuff out of the way, let me roll the introduction and we'll get in right into today's show. All right, and welcoming to the show, Marcel. I was going to try to say your last name, and I should ask you before the show, but I
Gautreaux.
won't butcher it. Gautreaux. Okay, Marcel Gautreaux. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing great. Got to be on.
Yeah, well, I'm very, very happy to have you here. And you come from a very interesting perspective. I know that you were a little bit down on some of our libertarian leaders, and as we were saying before the show, some of our mutual friends had spoke very highly of your perspective, which was interesting to say, or yeah, interesting to say the least. But I guess before we get into that, why don't you tell my audience and everybody who you are and what you do?
Sure. So, well, I'll tell you the first of those things. So I'm Marcel Gautreaux. I guess the main thing anybody on your audience should know that I do is I run, well, I'm a PhD economist from George Mason University. I am a fellow at the Mises Institute. I run what is called the Property and Freedom Book Club, which there will be a link to that, I assume, in your description, or if not, I'll just give one to you once we're done with the show and put it in the show notes. And of course, I'm everybody's favorite Twitter personality. And like most libertarians, I hate most other libertarians. So I've been very down on libertarian thought leaders.
Dude, I completely empathize with that. Over the last election cycle, there are definitely some things that I felt like were unforced errors and just like, oh man, I wouldn't have did that. But I try to have some empathy in some respects because I'm like, okay, well, also maybe they know something that I don't. Maybe there's a bigger picture here, but sometimes I don't feel like I'm always catching it. So, much like you, I look at most other libertarians and I'm like, oh my God, these people are just awful. Excuse me.
Yeah. I remember like the last time I interfaced with what we might call, you can call it mainstream libertarian politics, but I was a big believer, for example, in Michael Heiss's project to take over the Libertarian Party and the Mises Caucus. There were like a few moments where I had doubts. I remember the moment of greatest doubt was when the Mises Caucus was just straight up robbed. Like somebody had stolen their storage shed and taken all their camera equipment. And Michael Heiss's response was to try to like start a petition to make them give it back. And I was like, dude, what are you talking about? This is actual partisan stuff. But then they somehow did get their stuff back. So I was like, okay, I guess I kneel to Michael Heiss's superior judgment. But then seeing now Angela McArdle, just going into the Trump administration, seeing the LP be redefined as the party to free, it's a victimless crime, of course, but to free a drug dealer. I was like, okay, is this our mission? Was this why the Libertarian Party existed? Like, were they all there in 1979? It's like, let's never forget that if one day someone makes a decentralized drug stealing service, every other principle goes in the back seat if we can get that guy a pardon. No.
Yeah, I largely agree. Now, like I said, I try to have empathy with these people and kind of understand the position they're coming from. But people are going to think I'm some deranged leftist when I say this, but there's been this weird melding in the dissident right sphere and the libertarian sphere of, like, it's almost like QAnon slop, where they believe that Trump is going to save the world and we shouldn't criticize Trump because we should trust the plan. And the it's so bizarre to me. And I'm sure you know there's one specific person I'm talking about that's just like, he literally put out a tweet the other day. And I like this person. Him and I have DM'd plenty of times. We get along great, but I just, his hopium for Trump is just off the charts. He said, I look at my kids and I see the future that Trump is developing for them. I'm like, holy fuck, dude. Like, that is insane. And like, I'm sorry. I look at I'm going to be a dad here in a couple months. My wife's
congratulations.
Pregnant. Thank you so much. She's due in August. I would never think of anybody other than my wife and maybe my parents when I look at my daughter. Yeah, I wouldn't think the fucking president.
Like, man, Trump is really going to. Yeah. And I could forgive. I mean, maybe not that level of hopium, but, you know, I've only ever voted for one person in my entire life, and that was Donald Trump in 2016. Okay. Right. You know, when Trump got out and he was saying, you know, Hillary Clinton's the mother of ISIS. And actually, that was the primary thing. Oh, he told Jeb Bush that, you know, your brother lied about Iraq. You know, 9/11 happened on his watch. When he said that, you know, John McCain, oh, I prefer heroes that didn't get captured, and so on and so forth. Then, yeah, okay, I'm on. I'm in. Right. I was sold. I was a little reluctant because I was still in like a sort of a more naive libertarian phase, actually. I was thinking like, oh, well, you know, isn't the border wall like statist and collectivist and whatever? But then by the time election day rolled around, I'm like, yeah, screw that. I'm going to vote for him. I did it. And it was just disappointment after disappointment. And I think the final straw on supporting Trump for me was when he bombed Syria. I was like, okay, so there's nothing to be salvaged about it. And there were, if my politics were even different than that, then when he, when there was a government shutdown, and he's like, I'm not going to sign off on the budget until there's wall money. And then Nancy Pelosi somehow convinced him to sign a continuing resolution. If the wall were like a hot priority for me, that should have also just been a jump off point. Mm-hmm. And there were, I can think of probably plenty more. There was the continuing resolution. There was bombing Syria. There was firing Jeff Sessions. There was canceling the Kobach Commission. There's probably like five different ways in which Trump had like do or die moments. And he just died every single time. Depending on whether your issue was election integrity, whether your issue was even in the last moment vaccines, you know, no matter what it was, Donald Trump never failed to just put a knife firmly in the back of his voters. And the worst of it all was at the very, literally precisely 2 weeks actually before his last day, when he baited his supporters into entering the Capitol building for reasons truly unknown to anyone but himself and God. They all got arrested and he just chose not to pardon them, promising only during this election that he would pardon them if elected. And I had people telling me like, oh, it's not possible for presidents to give preemptive pardons for cases that haven't even started yet. Like, first of all, yes, they can. A president can do like a Squid Game pardon. He could be like, I'll pardon anybody who can like run a 10-minute mile if he wants. And sure enough, Joe Biden on his way out, he's like, oh, by the way, I pardoned my son Hunter for all manner of criminal degeneracy he may have done. And when I saw that, I was like, I can't believe Hunter did that. Like, no, I can believe he did that. I know that presidents can do that. I would do that if I was president. And I'm just mad that Trump didn't do it.
Yeah, there's so many things like that where it's just like Trump always, always fumbled the ball. And specifically, like, I'm still baffled at the people who say, oh, he's anti-war. Like, I've had people leading up to this election saying, oh, Trump's an anti-war president. I'm like, how do you jumble that? Like, you could say, yeah, he pays like lip service to it. But like, I don't know how you come to that conclusion that he was anti-war.
An anti-war president doesn't appoint John Bolton to a cabinet level position, right? He doesn't appoint, I want to say Mike Huckabee, although I think I might be getting the name. No, it's Mike Huckabee. Yeah.
Mike Huckabee. Right, Mike Huckabee and also Mike Pompeo.
Right. Exactly. You don't put these people in cabinet level positions if you're not pro-war. The discussion is over. And again, the discussion should have been over in 2016. I can absolutely, you know, as someone who voted for Trump in 2016, I forgive anybody who voted for Trump in 2016. As someone who didn't vote for Trump in 2020, I don't forgive you if you voted for Trump in 2020. That's
right. So I'm kind of curious your perspective on this, because this is kind of the way I was looking at it leading up to the election. And for full transparency, in case people don't already know, I voted for Gary Johnson in 2016. I voted for Joe Jorgensen. I think I donated maybe like 20 or 30 bucks.
You're to Joe Jorgensen's
campaign. Yeah. And then this is the first election where I just sat out and I didn't vote. My perspective leading up to 2024 between Trump and Kamala is that including Chase Oliver in here, because why the hell not? From the libertarian perspective that I think you and I mostly inhabit, I was looking at this as I don't forgive Marcel voting on 2016. Good to see you, Andy. But my perspective on this was that, Chase Oliver has actively ran against like the Ron Paul idea of libertarianism, right?
Yes.
And he basically spat in the face of a lot of the people who were in the Mises Caucus, which, you know, we can also, I'm sure, kind of dive into this a little bit later about how the Mises Caucus ended up with Chase Oliver as the presidential nominee. But once again, we'll get there. Chase Oliver was a spit in the face of the Ron Paul libertarians. And then Trump was at least paying lip service to libertarians and then saying, hey, I'll appoint one in the cabinet. He came to the Libertarian Party to pander for their votes. And yes, I think that was absolutely pandering. I don't think there was any serious hand extended, but at least he made active efforts to at least court these people. Do I think it was a sincere effort? No, I just think he was trying to get their vote. So if you were inclined to vote in 2024, I really think as a libertarian, your only option was Trump, because, okay, Chase Oliver is basically antithetical to any right-leaning libertarian. Trump can win, and at least he's paying lip service to the issues that matter to you. Would you agree with that, or where would you kind of stand in that whole situation?
I mean, honestly, gun to my head, if I had to vote, I would actually sooner just vote for Kamala just to make sure everybody is in like a proper war footing. Right? Like if when Trump is president, when Trump is president, everybody gets stupid, right? The only good reason I ever thought of, and I came up with it probably like a month before, I was like, well, I guess the only good thing about Trump winning, I thought this a month before, is like maybe it'll kill the dream, you know? Like I guess some people need to touch the stove a second time. They need to learn their lesson. They weren't ready to vote in 2016. You know, and so now this is like their first time learning from this experience. And it's like, no. When Trump is president, it puts like, you know, it's like Man Ray and the Orb of Stupidity, right? Where you turn it on, everyone's going, because they can't see what's there. Some of the finest minds I know, get right to that, you know, eventually, like, they just don't see what's there and they're just never going to learn. And in fact, some have become worse. You know, I know somebody, or I know of a major libertarian personality and thought leader, you know, who danced right back onto the index card, right? Who before would give these great speeches about, you know, how boring it is to listen to these fake debates, that, give me a break. And once Trump was elected, they started, well, we got to make the little gains and nobody's perfect and the lesser of two evils. I'm like, dude, what are you talking about? Right, like what, like this person, like what are you specifically talking about? So, you know, for that, I would rather have, you know, Kamala in president and we would just build up infrastructure to oppose her the next time around than let this demon into our camp, you know, and just destroy everything and cause everybody to humiliate themselves in foolishness.
Sure, yeah. A friend of mine, Red Hawk, always says accelerationism, and I'm not necessarily saying that you're endorsing this, but like accelerationism is a failed strategy because there's still leftists in South Africa. And that's just like is a little jab at it. You know, I think it's funny, but like
I should distinguish it. It's not accelerationism. Like accelerationism implies that I want Kamala in so that she will make things worse, so that like normies or whatever will radicalize. Like,
yeah,
I don't want Kamala in so she'll make things worse. I want Kamala in to just kick that can down the road, and then I'm just going to actively convince other people to not be stupid, right? It's not that I'm trying to get to normies and say, like, you know, look at Kamala. She's banned white people from existing. And now I bet you want to pick up the rifle and go hide in the woods. It's like, hey, just so you, just going to people that I know who should know better, it's like, hey, listen, Rabbi Shmuley cast a spell on you and made you want to vote for Trump. He's not president anymore, so he's going to die soon. So that spell's going to wear off. So can we please act normal with respect to intelligence services? You know, if Kamala Harris were to tell you that she's hiring Eric Prince to go invade Kenya or Haiti, now that she's president, you surely understand that's like fucking retarded, right? You know, that is what I want. It's not about accelerating the destruction of the American empire. This thing is doomed anyway. That's not what we're here for.
Yeah, I got you. Okay, so you know what? Maybe we could pivot over to this because Andy had said here in the comments, voting for the gummy that wrecked rectum walls, which was a very, very funny moment. And I've observed this phenomenon, I'm sure you have too, that like back in 2020, remember, they were all the Mises Caucus people were all in on Jacob Hornberger, right? He was our guy, and, you know, he was very, very big on open borders, which, you know, now all these people who have supported or who supported him back then now are closed borders. And like, I think it's the right position to be closed borders, but at the same time, they were all in on Jacob Hornberger. Now, all of a sudden, he's like persona non grata after, you know, when he tried to run again. And then, you know, Dave was going to run for president and then he backs out, and like, that's fine. But there was a lot of time between when he announced that he was going to potentially do it and when he pulled out. Like, there was a long, long time where, you know, there should have been some kind of plan, but clearly there wasn't any. So they get Michael Rechtenwald, and he seems pretty good, but like,
I think he seems pretty great these days.
It's pretty funny, but like, we were told that he's this great messenger and everybody's getting behind him, but it's just like, there was no enthusiasm there. And it was kind of like, he was like Joe Jorgensen, but a guy and a little bit more based.
A lot more based, but yeah.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. So yeah, what'd you think about kind of like the rug pull from that perspective?
I'll tell you, I don't remember what it was that even tanked Michael Rechtenwald. Well, not Rechtenwald, I know what tanked Hornberger the first time to even comment on it. I'm like, it's like so far out of mind. I only have these memories of Joe Jorgensen seemingly materializing out of the ether. I remember when Joe Jorgensen first became the nominee, there was seemingly only one photograph of her in existence in the universe, and they just kept using that same one for all. I was like, hold on, has anybody ever seen this woman from literally any other angle or photographed her for any reason? So the answer to that question was no.
Yeah. Yeah, it was funny to say the least. But
although it's because the Libertarian Party's the LP's primary structure is like the least democratic one possible. The second least democratic one is ironically the Democratic Party primary process, because that one just privileges like democratic elected officials, so that states with large amounts of democratic congressmen have an outsized say in like who the next democratic congressman can be or the next democratic president candidate could be. And then the Republican one, as we see, is actually the most responsive to public desire. Is the most responsive to public desire. And you can see that when the GOP establishment, when it was trying to stop Trump, and even Ron Paul had to resort to like Looney Tunes tricks. I remember in the Ron Paul 2012 days, they put a bunch of Ron Paul delegates on a bus and just started driving around the convention center and not letting them off, like that Keanu Reeves movie.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine being on that bus that day. But yeah, I everybody always brings up like in the when they would report the polling for the presidential nominees back like 2008 and 2012, it'd be like in first is whoever the hell was, Mitt Romney, and then in third it would be John McCain or somebody else, but they would never tell you who second is, which was always Ron Paul. And then it's so funny because like, in my mind, when you look at Trump, I remember people always saying he wasn't supposed to win. And like, okay, well, the logical conclusion of that is if he wasn't supposed to win, but he won, then wasn't he supposed to win if he won? Like, they got out Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders, no problem. So, you know, if you're saying it's all a rigged game and it's a big club, but nobody's allowed in it, but somehow Trump broke that game, it just like that whole deal never made sense to me.
Well, I guess you could square that by saying that Trump was working with, let's call it, a renegade faction of GOP decision makers, you know, that was able to just get him, you know, they were able to get him just the institutional in, and from there, his money just did the work. Something like that.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I'm not well-read enough on any of the kind of inside out there to, I guess, comment on that.
I mean, now the GOP is just a Trump creature. I remember when the Republican conference happened, and God, what were the greatest hits? So there's Wahiguru. We had the Hindu prayer. There was a lot more. I'll just say that. But we had Shabbos Kestenbaum speaking at both the GOP and Democratic National Committee conferences, and everybody was saying like, this is what Trump has to defeat. And I think Pedro Gonzalez did the best work, pointing out that Okay, I'm being told the song, but for the life of me, I can't remember. The Trump rap. Oh, oh yeah. FJP, 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 man. See, with the F, oh my God. Who's with the tattoo on her face? Cardi B, was it her? Who was like, I'm here and these are my people. In any case, it was a parade of degeneracy. I have a tweet right about it. I'll post it. Yeah. The point is, everybody was saying, oh, this is what Trump needs to defeat in the GOP. Like, no. Trump's family runs the convention now. Like, this is Trump's GOP. And Trump's GOP is just the pre-show before Mike Tyson fight.
Amber Rose. That's it.
Amber Rose. Thank you. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's so funny to me because I remember people saying, oh, Trump's not like the establishment now. I'm like, who's like the establishment Republicans at this point? Like, they're all in line with Trump. If you are a Republican in today's world and you run against Trump, you will lose. Like, I would say even as of like 2020, he kind of melded into the establishment because like there was the whole the CIA war, you know, CIA propaganda war against China. I was talking to Sarah from DDGeopolitics last night about this, where like it was like the 2024 election was basically the PayPal mafia and the CIA Trump versus the Justice Department and the FBI. And that's some woke corporations. That's pretty much what it was. But people are like, what do you mean? Like Tucker Carlson aspired to join the CIA. You know, all these right wing grifters are all fucking connected to the CIA. The Falun Gong, the Epic Times, who purchased like most of YouTube ads, or literally, a National Endowment for Democracy cut out. They got money from USAID. And then obviously, you know, the Democrats are the Democrats. But like the CIA was in large part the people who backed Trump. And then, you know, your Eric Prince and all these guys. Like, it's just insane that people, like you said, they remove their thinking head when they look at Trump in this respect.
This is, if you're running a Republican, I think actually the best thing for you, I think by the numbers, is for Trump not to talk about you at all. Because the congressmen that Trump endorses actually tend not to win, but the congressmen Trump attacks also tend not to win. So the best thing when Trump is like looking at your district is to like stand perfectly still and don't move and hope that he just, you know, he just passes by and passes along. And the Trump victory also, I think, puts an end to, you know, one of the, well, I don't say bad, it's a bad, well, one of the less useful euphemisms, which is that of the deep state, because Joe Biden in that way was a deep state candidate. And it lost.
Yeah, I always thought, like, when you see Benjamin Netanyahu saying deep state, I'm like, all right, this word is lost all meaning.
Dead giveaway, yeah. I mean, this was, Alex Jones is always the biggest hint. Like, when you see Alex Jones repeating a talking point, you know, okay,
yeah. Yeah, the talking point's not officially soiled. So, yeah,
I'm kind like, of, you know, the deep state, we talked about the banksters. I'm like, all right, can't use that one anymore. If it's safe enough for him, it's bad for us.
Yeah, I agree. So kind of circling back to the LP stuff, it seems like the Mises caucus is just kind of like, I don't want to say in shambles, but like it's nowhere to be found anymore, because obviously a lot of that camp went for Trump. But though, like, how do you claim the Libertarian Party can be useful when, you know, the base people took over the Libertarian Party and you ended up with Chase Oliver as your candidate? I watch The Watchmen. Netanyahu saying deep state is like Blair White saying woke.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. Yeah. The LP ending up with Chase Oliver after the MC takeover. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, it's the least democratic one, and LP insiders still, or actually really veteran LP members still have this outside say in the thing. So, and Chase Oliver was very much picked, if nothing else, to be the anti Mises caucus candidate. Like, there's a broad coalition specifically to make sure that the LP, that the Mises caucus didn't get what it wanted. How that can be undone, I guess you could just do the Mises caucus thing a second time. There were occasions in which Michael Heiss like left people in positions to make clear that he wasn't at war with the party. And it's like, excuse me, sir, I'm at war with the party. I don't know what we're talking about right now. But if the LP can't be used, then the work will just have to be done creating a fourth party. Like, you can't stick on a mistake just because you spent, was it 1979? So 2025. So about 46 years making it, right? Mm-hmm. At a certain point, you just need to say, okay, we're going to make a new, again, parallel infrastructure. But there was also this idea that the LP was supposed to be winning elections, which just can't be what it is. In the system that the United States has, the only thing that a third party can do is have a coherent list of demands in its platform, and then just start furiously spoiling elections, forcing in an adversarial way either party to move in their direction. That's the only real way. Like, you have to threaten your vote. You can just not vote, but the only problem with not voting is that there's theoretically a myriad of reasons why you might not have voted, and so it doesn't send a clear signal. Voting for a third party and then someone loses is a clear signal. It's like, why did 171,000 libertarians not vote for me? Well, here's a list of 20 demands that they have. And so figure out which of those you didn't fulfill and then peel them off. That's the only leverage you have in this current system. That, or you could do, if you had the money and the infrastructure for this, you could set up a think tank / lobbying group, which does what the ADL, or not the ADL, what AIPAC does, which is not that you pay politicians to do what you say, rather you build up this war chest of money and you're ready to pump it into any politician that, or against any politician that doesn't do what you say. So for example, Ilhan Omar's primary, her Democratic primaries, always pull in more money than the generals and primaries of every adjacent district combined. So whoever it is that defeats Ilhan Omar will not be swimming in AIPAC money. However, Ilhan Omar has guaranteed by her own behavior that all of her opponents on literally every level of democratic process will swim in that money. So you can either do that, if you had the money for it, I don't, or you have to set up a third party and then just start forcing Republicans to lose, or Democrats to lose if you think you can move them. Really, just run every district and just see who you move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that. And the political solution to me is just such like a sticky one because, you know, I people say, oh, just go join the GOP. And it's like, okay, well, that's a beast of its own. And are you sure that you're going to be welcome? And then you have to worry about, okay, well, what do I have to compromise in order to get in the office? And is it worth compromising that? And then like the Libertarian Party, you know, at a local level, okay, maybe. But to your point, I don't know how much this idea of spoiling works. Because like, look at like the Blake Masters situation. And in my mind, that was kind of like a disaster because this is a dude who literally made a commercial. God, it was so laughable. And I'm sure you know what commercial.
He was like a Randian objectivist, wasn't he?
He was like some anarcho-capitalist that like the last thing he wrote one article about how the war in Iraq was bad like 20 years ago. And then after that, nobody ever heard from him again. And then all of a sudden he pops up one day again with a bunch of Peter Thiel money. And after October 7th, he says, you know, kids on college campuses really hate Jews. And I'm like, this is the dude that we're like running to endorse. Oh, and then he also said on Dave Smith's Part of the Problem, what happens when China storms the beaches of California? Like, are you fucking stupid, dude? Come on.
Yeah. I mean, people who say that these join the Republican Party, they have an idea which is not unjustifiable if we're just speaking colloquially, but it is a problem if you start building a strategy off of it, which is they think the Republicans are idiots. And what I mean is they think that the Republican Party is like this untamed wilderness of people that have basically no ideology that you can just sort of plant down. You know, they feel like almost like the colonizers, right? They're like, you know, they're like Lewis and Clark exploring the untrammeled wilderness that is the Republican field. Like all these people, all these normies, my boomer grandpa, he's just waiting to take my niche far-right ideology. Right now, he's sort of grazing the fields of, you know, just Republican slop. But as soon as I can tame him, get a lasso around him and bring him over, but you got to not spook him, right? If I spook him by showing him my real ideology, it'll, you know, he'll bolt away and I won't be able to tame the wilderness. That's not what it's like. The GOP is an enemy civilization. You're basically sailing up and you're trying to colonize like Manhattan right now. Like, I want you to imagine Henry Hudson or Hernan Cortez or whoever in his, you know, 18th century galleon, and they're landing in like Times Square, and they're talking about it as if it's untamed. It's like, God, we're gonna steal these natives' taxes. Like, dude, there's an entire infrastructure here to prevent random Spanish-speaking migrants from stealing people's stuff. It might not do anything, but they're here. So in the same way, when you're like, oh, I'm gonna join the Republican Party, the Republican Party is like ready and willing. They're actually more eager for you as somebody with a niche right-wing ideology to annihilate you, to throw you into the sun, than any liberal or any leftist that joins the party. The GOP welcomes former leftists into the party. But if you say like, oh no, I'm like a super radical libertarian, I'm in America First, God forbid. I'm pretty sure Nick Fuentes, like by name, you know, it's like he's on a terror list. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing for you there of like joining in. You're just, if you want to be Republican, then go be a Republican by all means, if that is what your politics are. But then just don't tell me about whatever niche or alternative or dissident politics that you have, because you will never manifest that preference. Not only will you not manifest it in policy, you won't even manifest it in your speech as soon as you're Republican. Everything you do becomes consumed by not scaring Republicans and your politics. Like, you don't move the GOP in your direction. You move, and you move hard into the GOP's direction. And, you know, it reaches its apotheosis when you have, you know, when you have Republicans who just do like the same racist dog whistles they were doing during the Clinton administration. And you're like, God, this proves that we're moving the Overton window. You know, J.D. Vance said what everybody was thinking, or J.D. No, not what everybody's thinking. Actually, they can't even go that far. They say J.D. Vance really moved the needle with that Haitians eating cats thing, because now he's gotten Americans to realize that Haitians are not good people to live around. It's like, that's your needle move? Getting, you know, who knows that? Haitians. Dominicans know that. Like, literally everybody in the Western Hemisphere knows this, right? Yeah. The idea that, like, no, this is our big victory. We've started the conversation. Okay. Once you have that conversation, once you move everybody into basically what is like a 95% consensus opinion, you know, not counting friends and family, no, 99.5%. What is the policy change that you expect to happen from that? Mm-hmm. You know, the numbers I give, you know, the year my parents got married, the year before I was born, safely more than 9 months, of course, before I was born, national polling data showed that a supermajority in both parties thought the country would be better without my parents in it, right? Because they were immigrants. They weren't born here.
Okay, yeah.
If public policy was in any way a determinant, sorry, if public opinion was in any way a determinant of public policy, I wouldn't be here. My very presence, right, lecturing you about how the Overton window isn't real, is in fact hard evidence that the Overton window was not real. If it was real, I wouldn't exist, or I would be in the crystal, right? I'd be back on the island. But I'm here because your opinion, everything in politics is or for the most part, you know, Age of Entitlement talks about this, is just downstream of contrived litigation, you know, aggressive lobbying, and so on and so forth. And you find that people who are on, you know, I'm trying to be careful with my words, the people who are alternatively on the right, you know, who are dissidently on the right, are the idea of like taking politics seriously is completely anathema to them. They don't want to be mean to Republican officials. They don't want to be adversarial to them in any fashion. They don't even want to, like, you to privately in your heart say bad things about them. And it's like, but you're not, if you are a reliable constituency, then you don't get what you want. You know who gets what, like, squeaky wheel gets the grease, so start squeaking. Mm-hmm. But they don't want to do this. They're like, well, they don't need us to win, and so if we speak against them, then they'll win and they won't help us. It's like, well, they don't need us to win. Why would they do anything for you? It's this weird double talk where it's like, you know, okay, I'm going to denounce Trump for his constant betrayal of his voter base. It's like, well, Trump doesn't need you. Well, then great. Then I'll keep denouncing him then. It's like, no, stop it. Because if we all denounce him, then Trump will win and then he won't help us. But, hold on. Why not denounce him then? Like, if it's all the same and you get what you want either way, you know, you think Trump rewards his friends and punishes his enemies? Quite the opposite. Trump regularly rewards his enemies and leaves his friends to be punished.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And this kind of goes over to a couple areas I wanted to discuss as well, because, you know, the big thing that I've been talking about a lot recently is kind of the whole punishment on the basis of criticizing Israel. And I see so many people saying, oh, this will never come for Americans. It's okay. Well, first of all, it objectively has. I mean, you could look up.
It already has. It's already been like Americans are always, really, frankly, the first to get it. The only thing that's ever happened to Arab Americans that haven't happened to American Americans, no, it's just getting shot, right? So there was a Palestinian activist by the name of, I do believe, Alex Oda, who was just shot dead in California. And I was saying, no American has been, but actually John F. Kennedy was. So there you go. So, you know, plenty of Americans also get killed. It's not even like, oh, and this is again another problem of, like, if you were just a basic libertarian, you would probably be closer to the truth than whatever off-ramp you've taken into justifying effectively just Zionist criminality. But yeah, this knife, this club is always used against you. There's a while where Matt Walsh was like, oh, well, we need at least a carve out so that we can like talk about like basic Christian doctrine without getting whammied. And they gave that. There's in the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, they say, okay, we made an exception for saying that Jews kill Jesus. Okay, so automatically, let's tell everybody who's into that kind of politics that Jews kill Jesus is not a useful line of political argumentation. Because the fact that the anti-Semitism law actually made a carve-out exception for you to say it should tell you that it's a total dead end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's amazing how many people said, oh, we're voting for Trump on the basis of free speech, but then, like, we've had... I've made this comparison so many times, but it's like, okay, if Joe Biden had deployed anti-transgender task forces or like pro-transgender task forces to major universities and cities, people would be like, what the fuck is going on? But for some reason, like, even our most famous libertarian commentators they're completely silent on it. Like, the fact that Trump's sending anti-Semitism task force all over the country, and then Bobby Kennedy, the first thing he says is, oh, anti-Semitism is an illness. Pandemic. Yeah, like, what?
These people, the other idea they have, and it's truly fantastical, but so when the Claudine Gay thing was happening, when they contrived plagiarism or whatever against her, and there are people, I mean, I knew people who were really just were excited. It's like, you know, we finally, you know, it's progress, though, because we've gotten this, like, uppity Brown out of Harvard. And I was like, listen, I'm not even going to address that, right? Mm-hmm. I don't care. But the person that's just going to replace her is also going to believe in, like, you're going to get somebody worse because you're going to have somebody who believes in all the DEI things and is just a huge hypocrite for criminality and for Jewish feelings. And actually, you just got an actual Jewish guy, right? Mm-hmm. And that's all you're going to get all the way down. And you should expect this even like for university admissions, because think about it. Every person, whoever is behind the desk deciding whether or not to give a student visa, right, to someone whose name is, you know, Ali Abdel Saud Muhammad, they're like, well, you know, damn, there's a chance this person might be anti-Israel. And if he's in good academic standing, we can't get rid of him. So that we got to think twice about this, right, before we let him in. We don't know what we're bringing in. If it's just a matter of law that, like, oh no, if you do an anti-Israel, then we deport you, that means they're more attractive. It's the reason you hire Mexicans. It's because they can't go and collect their wages. That's why, in the same reason, you're going to start flooding your universities with Indians. Well, Indians love Israel anyway, right? With Pakistanis, with all sorts of Muslims now more than you would have before, because now you know that you can, like, hold this sword over their necks if they step out of line. I remember when the Hall Pass went out, there was one case where there was a, I think it was the same university with the frat chads, which was like AA, well, I think it turned out to be AE Pi, a Jewish fraternity. But there was one case where there's this guy wearing an American flag overalls, and he was like grunting and making like gorilla ape noises at this black woman that was walking by on the quad. And I was like, this is not for his benefit. There were people that are like, this just goes to show that if we keep, you know, co-signing Jewish criminality, then now we get to make ape noises at black people. It's like, okay, first of all, that's not a political, I mean, okay, I guess it was pretty funny, but it's not a political objective, right? And more importantly, that's not for your benefit, that's for hers, right? That is the equivalent of, you know, she's on a space station called the Cathedral. She's on a space station called the Cathedral, right? And they put her in the airlock, okay? And they said, hey, you know, what do Scientologists call you? Like a drag personality or whatever? You're like, you're a suppressive personality, right? And they're like, you know, and she's like, so what? You know, I'm strong, right? What are you gonna do about it? And what they do is they, you know, they close the airlock and they just start letting the air leak out, right? Mm-hmm. But instead of like her skin going purple, it's like a bunch of white guys yelling at her and making ape noises. And she's like, you know, like, are you ready to stop being a suppressive personality? He's like, yeah, I'm sorry, right? And they close it back up and they let her back in, and she knows. You know, the people who have all these same loose and progressive orthodoxies, but they're just hypocritical in Israel, are worse, right? Claudine Gay was in trouble because she just accidentally supported free speech, right? She's getting punished for the wrong thing. And I had somebody in a group chat with me saying, like, okay, yes, that's the message we're getting, but the left isn't going to receive that message. Like, the message is intended for the left, right? Of course they're going to see the message. The guy was trying to say, we on the right, who are smart on the right, we get the message that it's for Israel. And the left gets the message for this for Israel. But, it, you know, the right-wing base, they will be, like, encouraged because they know that the left can be harmed. Mm-hmm. I said, but that means that you are happy because you're getting a correct message. The entire left is getting a correct message, but your army is getting the wrong message? Does that make any sense? You know, like, would you want to live in a situation, if you're at war, do you want a situation where, like, you know something, like, you, an officer, though you have no power, you, an officer, know something is an ambush, the enemy knows something is an ambush, but your soldiers don't know it's an ambush, and it's just something only you know? No. Because you can't have your fingers on every soldier. They're going to start walking into this trap and just, like, stepping on rakes and getting hit with it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a cheese. So one thing I've also kind of seen, and you sent me your talk on tariffs. I made it about halfway through when I was kind of working last night. And I've begun to see people argue for tariffs. And I have to be honest, I've just not seen a convincing or like really compelling argument. The most convincing one is that, like, hey, we would much rather incentivize consumption at home. But, like, when you look at today's context with tariffs, it's like, okay, we have no manufacturing base. It's not like we're even promising to build factories here. A lot of that stuff's over in China, and it's not just because, like, they have the factories, they also have the talent over there right now. Now, I think that Americans can do these jobs. It's just a muscle we haven't flexed in a while. People are arguing, oh, tariffs are a great way to punish this country, you know, China, let's say, and then also bring manufacturing back. And to me, I'm like, why don't you just say, hey, we're going to remove taxes off of people who have businesses here? Like, it's so stupid to me. So I know that's a little bit of a rant on tariffs, but yeah. Your thoughts on kind of how
America is basically like a increasingly becoming like a post-industrial state. And it's supplemented by like a growing class of basically like immigrant slaves. Even if you were to bring back manufacturing, the people that support this, I'll just tell them, you tax supporter, those jobs are not coming back for white people, right? What you're going to get is like a million Akron, Ohio's, where all those cat-eating Haitians that you were worried about before, every new chicken farming, every new chicken processing factory, every new like steel mill, they're just going to come in, and then also DHS is going to bring in a bunch of Haitians to work those jobs, right? Like, Haitians are going to be processing chickens no matter what. That is for the modal Haitian, that is their lot. That is the level of economic productivity they have. And so your only decision is, will they be plucking those chickens in Haiti, or will they be plucking those chickens in Akron, Ohio? Now, when Eric Prince invades Haiti and all those Haitians are in the system, right? They're all fingerprinted. You know, they've gotten their retinal scans like in Fallujah. Mm-hmm. They're in the system, which means like when it comes time to apply for the work permit in America, 80% of the paperwork is already done. That's what you're getting when A, you support these neocolonial schemes, and B, when you start trying to pull in like really like low tier industry jobs into the United States. Mm-hmm. Americans are just, for a variety of reasons, a highly educated, highly productive people. And even doing, you know, services for productive people is itself productivity. Like, if I said I'm going to go to Haiti and like shine shoes, the only thing I'm doing is like saving time and value for the average Haitian that they could be doing for what, right? On the other hand, if I'm like in Wall Street shining shoes, like I'm saving like precious minutes off of this Wall Street executive's day, and his minutes are extremely valuable. That's why I get paid a lot. Like, this is not just me like glazing Wall Street executives. Like, this is why pay varies between countries, right? Everything you do is saving effort for someone else. And so the value of your labor is how much of that person's time that you're saving and how valuable their time is. So trying to bring these jobs back to America, they're not going to go to the Americans you think they're going to go to. Mm-hmm. And since America is, again, like, you know, a post-industrial state, even the best arguments for protectionism that I can see do not apply in the case of America. Our entire tariff structure is actually almost the exact opposite. So the talk that you watched was by a guy, or was about a guy named Friedrich List, who was like the father of protectionism. And in the talk I was giving, I was making the case that a lot of his underlying sort of reasoning was proto like Austrian, as opposed to being like proto Keynesian or proto Marxist. If you were like, which group has like the closest lineal descent, it's actually the Austrians. I was trying to make the case for that. But America subsidized like primary goods, right? You know, corn, oil, things like that. And for Liz, it's like, no, you want to be moving away. You want to be, so to speak, in the Marxist sense, alienated from labor as possible. You want to be moving as far away from agriculture, as far away from extraction, you know, pushing to a new frontier of industrial supremacy. And then once you reach that position of economic supremacy, you want to close the tariffs, or rather you want to remove the tariffs. That way, all the firms that you've built up, you know, you got to see, like, okay, how much of those are actually useless. You otherwise, you end up in a situation like South Korea's in, where they have to regularly bail out, I forgot the name of the shipping firm, that is it Daewoo? I think it's Daewoo, right? Like, the largest shipping firm in the world operates out of South Korea.
And yeah, Daewoo's a GM subsidiary, if I remember correctly.
Daewoo. Then it's a different one.
Okay, yeah. It's all right. I'm sorry to interrupt your flow, but yeah. I
was going to look it up and I'll just...
Okay, yeah. I work for General Motors, so Daewoo's basically... Yeah, I think it's the Korean brand of General Motors.
Hanjin, maybe? No. Whatever it is. I'll remember it at some point.
That's okay.
Point is, they regularly need bailouts because they cannot stand up to competition. But even in the Listian prescription, once you reach the top, right, you know, Britain was right once it had taken this stance of economic supremacy and built up these factories to immediately switch to unilateral free trade, because they're the only producer of industrial goods. So the only thing, therefore, that their tariffs are restricting is their ability to get cheap inputs to turn into expensive outputs. Right. And then once you're, you know, back on the bottom, then you protectionism your way back to the top. There's a lot to dispute here in economic terms, but that's the best possible argument. That does not apply to the United States. The United States is the foremost economic power, right? It is a financial capital. There's nothing tariffs are going to do. You know, all of the things that are made in America already are made using, you know, input goods that are made in China. Like, we've reached, feels counterintuitive, but we've reached in some ways the next level. Where for the British, they needed like cheap wood to put in their factories to then make like expensive furniture. And we are like one step like phased over, and that the thing that we're getting from China is not like the raw input good. We're getting like a finished industrial good, and we're turning the finished industrial good into a good or service.
Okay. Yeah, I understand that. I've had people argue with me about this, where it's like, okay, well, you know, we need to suffer a little bit because these tariffs are going to make our lives better. But, you know, I think about this every here and there. And, you know, I realize that like comfort for a lot of people is kind of what we're mostly suffering from here in the United States, right? Where like, you know, as we get further and further ahead, you know, technologically, our lives get better and better in some respect. But then also, you know, we're alleviating suffering, but that suffering also kind of like came with, you know, better birth rates and like more social cohesion. So like, is there like a delicate balance here that we could walk? Or, you know, because I am of the mind that like, if we can alleviate suffering and meaningless jobs, you know, if we just want to bring jobs back, then we'll just get rid of all the, you know, heavy machine equipment and give people spoons to dig shovel or, you know, dig ditches with. But we have excavators and stuff like that because it saves time and, like you said, alleviates suffering and gives people opportunities to do other things that they could, you know, they could do rather than spending their time digging ditches. So, you know, I'm always kind of torn with like, okay, well, is there like a balance here, or is there just other reasons that we, there's just so much to this equation. So I know I'm kind of rambling, but
yeah, I would say, I mean, the primary issue with every new technology is that it's being put into a system that can be at best described as like an anarcho-tyranny. So, you know, in principle, something like Airbnb would be great. The problem is not all house guests are created equal, right?
Yeah.
And this applies, I mean, basically all the way down, right? In theory, ChatGPT would be great. The problem is it's like hypersensorious, right? The problem is that, you know, every firm is trying to be, you know, is trying to be the first recipients of like BlackRock money. And that means, you know, every new innovation in information technology becomes a new vector of like basically psychic attack against the people. Every new innovation in improved social spaces becomes a new vector for violent.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
Criminal behavior on the American people. But the problem is not the technology. The problem is that we have a system which, again, can be politely described as dysfunctional, but I would really describe as like existentially hostile to its own citizens and the rest of the world. You know, it's like, you know, do you want the Soviet Union getting like nuclear reactors? Like, nuclear reactors are a great technology, just not in the hands of Soviet commissars. First, assuming it works in their hands and they don't do something dumb like put graphites on the fuel rods, but just the fact that it does work, you know, in this hostile state means every nuclear reactor they get is another nuclear weapon in Stalin's hands. It's, you know, it makes it cheaper to buy security surveillance cameras, just for a very crude example. So the fact that our current, you know, basically totalitarian system of racial terror, frankly, makes use of all these technologies, or it removes certain ways that people have coped with previous dysfunction, right? So you can read Age of Entitlement. It's a great book by Chris Caldwell. But you can see all the different ways that, you know, your average, you know, middle-class white American has found to escape the cities. And each new technology, you know, God forbid jetpacks are invented, right? Because then it's like easy transport into the suburbs. Like, God, we're going to have to move even further away. You see what I'm saying? So that, among other reasons why I think like the fear of technology being socially stable, like, no, you live in a totalitarian state. That totalitarian state hates your guts. You found loopholes. Each new technology is like a new thing you didn't realize that you did not cover.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So the other thing that I think a lot of people kind of bring up, and I'm definitely kind of in this camp as well, is that, you know, right now is we can't have libertarianism because we've had open borders for so long, kind of like what you were talking about, narco-tyranny. We need to kind of have a crackdown and get rid of all the people who are here illegally and the undesirables, and also kind of rein in the radical left in order to have some semblance of a sanity. Where do you kind of stand on that?
So the presence of, I'm guessing, so a bunch of like non-white minorities who don't believe in libertarianism, they're all collectivists and so on and so forth. You have a bunch of leftists who also don't believe in libertarianism. Then you're just never getting libertarianism, right? Like, if that's it, if you really believe that, then you're just never going to get it. But for one, assuming we're just speaking in racial terms, America's demographic situation is like totally screwed anyway, right? Mm-hmm. So if that's what you're waiting for. But a country can bear a great many, you know, a great many mixes if it has like good legal institutions, right? If there is, mm-hmm. you know, right now we have a left that up until October 7th considered itself to be wholly above the law, right? Mm-hmm. You know, various minority groups are empowered at the expense of Gentile whites. And, you know, for as long as their power rests on having, you know, the therapeutic state to shield them from the consequences of their own actions or incompetence, then they're going to support that state. But you're not here to convince them, right? Like, you should be thinking, okay, that's a problem. So that's a problem to be solved. But there's no here to there where you vote in like a Republican administration that promises mass deportations, which it won't deliver on. And then if it does deliver on it, it only deports all the anti-Semitic ones, because that means all the ones, you know, all the philo-Semitic ones that come in are even more reliant on like the largesse of the state to shield them from, I guess, their own hypocrisy. Like, they have the same worldview, and also they're like moral hypocrites.
Mm. So I don't want to follow that up, because like I said, people, I kind of understand the argument that they're coming from, but you basically, your theory, and please make sure, you know, tell me if I'm getting this right, is that, basically like you won't vote your way out of this in a certain respect, but also, I don't want to put this.
I mean, you can use voting as a political act, just not
sure.
Just yeah. directly voting for a party. Like, you can engage in strategic voting. You can vote for a local candidate that you think is good, but you're not going to get what you want voting for candidates that are not going to give you what you want.
Okay.
Right? There's no right. combination of voting for people that are opposed to you that will lead you to getting political authority. You have to either decide somebody's satisfactory and then you get what you get. You probably won't even get what you get, but you might get what he's selling. Assume he's lying, especially if you're dealing with Donald Trump or anybody around him. But otherwise, yeah, just withhold your vote and spoil. Any other thing is just going to lead to you you know, politically demobilizing yourself and making excuses, you get shafted.
Okay. Well, you know what? I think that's a pretty good good segue into kind of something I really wanted to talk to you about, specifically about the space that I think we kind of alluded to on and off air, where, you know, Dave is a friend of mine and he's been on the show before and he has an open invitation to come back. He's just impossible to reach. But,
you know, I was supposed to have been on a show a few years ago. That's the real reason I'm really so mad at him, is because he promised I would be on, and, you know, 2017, and he just never got back to me.
Yeah. What a shame. Yeah. He's just, he's insanely busy. And, you know, I do think he is doing great work, but, you seem to have some criticism of him in regards to his Israel-Palestine debates. And I've always learned a lot from him, but also I do not profess to be some greatly informed Israel-Palestine expert. I definitely know more than the average person, but I would by no means consider myself an expert. I mean, I'm very, very good friends with, like I told you on and off air, all the guys from the Libertarian Institute and antiwar.com. Been on my show plenty of times, hung out with them in person, love those guys dearly. They know way more than I do, and I rely on them a lot. And I know Dave does as well. You know, he watches Dave DeCamp's show, keeps up with him, keeps up with Connor, keeps up with Kyle Anzalone, who are all just very, very great resources for this kind of stuff. I think this was shortly after the Douglas Murray and obviously Dave Smith debate. What's kind of like,
it was a Josh Hammer debate, actually. The Douglas Murray one made it even worse, but the Josh.
Okay. Go ahead. Take it away.
Yeah. So the simplest way to articulate the problem, I think Walter Block demonstrated it most of all. The case of Jeremy Hammond makes it super instructive, even though Jeremy Hammond, I can't speak fully to how hostile, if he matches my level, but Jeremy Hammond has debated Rafi Farber and he's debated Alan Futterman, who are both Walter Block's co-authors on his two extended books justifying, you know, the various crimes the Jews are perpetrating in Palestine. Mm-hmm. When it came time to debate Walter Block, right, when he got kicked from the Mises Institute, and then for a variety of things, including bugging DiLorenzo to host a debate called Is Genocide Good or Bad? Right. Walter Block refused to debate Jeremy Hammond, but he was willing to debate Dave Smith. So I will give explanations, but I don't need to give any explanation for why I don't want Dave Smith debating. All anybody needs to do is just close their eyes and ask themselves whatever explanation you have, right? Make one up. Why did he want to debate Dave Smith, but not Jeremy Hammond? If Jeremy Hammond is, you know, perfectly a qualified debater, what did Walter Block see in Dave Smith willing to debate him, right?
He saw his followers. Hmm? I think he saw his followers.
Oh, that Dave Smith had more followers and was like more famous?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he knew it would probably get him eyes, and then probably because he felt like he might be a little bit easier to beat than somebody because he's not as well versed on the topic as someone like Jeremy Hammond.
Yeah, so it would be I would take certainly the latter case. Okay. And the other people that Dave Smith has debated include Dennis Prager, Batya Ungar-Sartre. So Dennis Prager of Prager University, a man who couldn't even beat Merrick Ohana in an argument. Batya Ungar-Sargon, who was actually the one who first blew the whistle on Ilhan Omar. She was the one who got Ilhan Omar on It's All About the Benjamins. Debating Laura Loomer, debating Josh Hammer, and now debating, you just said his name.
Oh, Douglas Murray.
Douglas Murray, who runs literally the Henry Jackson Institute, which is named after Henry Scoop Jackson, who was like a clearinghouse for New York conservatives. So all of these people are willing to debate Dave Smith. You won't see any of them debating, for the sure point of example, the likes of Max Blumenthal, the likes of Glenn Greenwald, you know, even other Jewish people, right? Because Dave Smith, one, is incredibly ignorant. His debate with Walter Block proved this. And two, as he said, he's not an anti-Israel guy. He's a pro-America guy, which means the only moral frame he's really willing to stick to is that murder is bad. But he's not even willing to fully attack the fact that, no, America is supporting a consistent, predictable pattern of criminality, and that criminality is upheld on a foundation of deception. So, for example, he wasn't even willing to say when Josh Hammer asked him about 9/11, so you're saying that, you know, are you saying that you trust Osama bin Laden more than Netanyahu? And Dave Smith's, like, backed out of that. Right. Even though it should have been like an easy layup, the fact that as a comedian with a high verbal IQ, right? He wasn't willing to just say, okay, Josh Hammer is trying to G-check me. Yes, Netanyahu is an inveterate liar. I'm willing to express my contempt for him and say, you know, I believe Osama over Osama bin Laden's thoughts. That he was unwilling to do that indicates, again, a fundamental temperament issue. Besides the fact of his, like, extreme ignorance of all things Palestine outside of, like, what we see in front of his eyes. And it would be one thing. Listen, if Dave Smith just was on part of the problem and he had people on his show and he's like, you know, I just think it's really rough what they're doing there, I would have no complaints. But he keeps being brought in to higher and, you know, higher and higher rated podcasts, more and more like universities, think tanks and whatever to represent, you know, the pro-America position against these like veteran Zionists. Again, people like Dennis Prager. Dennis Prager has been doing Zionist activism, frankly, since he first drew breath, but certainly since like the early 1980s, right? Josh Hammer has written multiple books. Walter Block has published hundreds of papers, right? He's been at this a very long time. And none of them are willing to do some of their own size. In the best case example, I would compare this to if after Jesus, you know, fully occulted, I think it would be an occultation, right, back into heaven. And, you know, Simon Peter is going around spreading the word of Jesus. And what you end up happening is Caiaphas, the high Sadducee, is hosting debates with, like, the blind and deaf guy that Jesus healed up, right? And the blind and deaf guy is like, Jesus touched my eyes and I could see. And he is the Messiah, right? And as you can imagine, like, Caiaphas is going to be like, okay, right? He's going to run the table on this guy. Now imagine if, like, every Sadducee, you know, from, like, Damascus to Jaffa kept inviting in this same, like, formerly blind and mute guy to have the same debate. At a certain point, you'd be like, hold on, is anybody going to debate, like, Saul of Tarsus? Is anybody going to debate, you know, Simon Peter? Is anybody going to debate, like, Jacob or John or whoever? No, you're just going to keep going after this blind guy? Same deal.
Okay.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. It seemed like he won. I would think most of those debates, because I think it's a pretty easy, you know, it's a pretty easy debate to win right now. Like, granted, for me, I'm not a debater. I did one debate on Israel-Palestine. I did not come in sufficiently prepared, and I'll admit I lost that one just because I didn't prepare correctly. But, you know, Laura Loomer is a loon. You know, Dennis Prager, like you said, couldn't beat this, whoever you mentioned in an argument. He had like nothing. Douglas Murray, you know, fell back on You Never Been and Straw Man and just total Hezbollah talking points. But like, I think much to your point is that like, you can't bring up like the whole WASPing, I think it's called, where they literally, you know, the IDF soldiers literally tie a necklace around a Palestinian's neck and then tell them to go, you know, basically feel out minefields. Or the example of them killing Shireen Abla Ekle or whatever the heck her name was, the journalist that said press. Like, there are egregious things that the IDF has done to Palestinians. And like, anytime they say, oh, well, but my human shields, you can say, okay, well, what about the actual fact that Hamas, you know, the Mossad headquarters are in like a residential neighborhood in Israel? Yes. Like, there's Dave so Smith, many things. Yeah, good.
He wins debates, but the points that he is defending are points that could be made and are made and are made better by Israelis, right? Mm-hmm. Like, just normal, even just left of center Israelis, that the IDF's operation in Gaza is too strong or that they're going too hard or whatever, right? But he's not willing and not able to really make a hard moral case against this entire exercise, right? He's not equipped for it. I remember in the Walter Block debate, he referred to the occupation and expulsion of Palestinians that began in 1967, which either he was accepting the Nakba, right, because he just supports it, or he didn't know that 48 and 67 are two separate things. Either of those things, I would absolutely forgive if you said it to me, because you are not one side of a debate on Israel. Dave Smith is one side of a debate on Israel, and that side is a very constrained one within the bounds of basically Jewish-Israeli public opinion. You know, he's basically a voice telling other Jews, you know, you've gone a little bit too far, and you should go a little bit less far if you want to stop the backlash against us. And he said this multiple times, even about Nick Fuentes, where he's like, he's not even talking to Nick Fuentes or his audience, not that they would listen, but he said it multiple times, his audience is for the most part other Jews and just other people on the left, where he's like, you know, you're going a bit far and you got to listen to what people are saying and like address their concerns. And so he's just there to convince them to be like a little bit less murderous, a little bit less psychotic. But I'm not here to give advice to Dennis Prager on how to be less of a psychopath. I'm not here to give advice to Josh Hammer or Walter Block or Douglas Murray on how to be less psychotic. I know what they are. What I want is somebody who will also demonstrate precisely what they are. And Dave Smith is either unwilling or unable, and I, at this point, unwilling, right? Unwilling to do that or to facilitate anybody doing that.
Mm. Yeah.
And when I pointed out what he was doing, he's like deliberately evaded. He's like, I'm not enforcing a cordon of acceptable opinion. And I said, like, you know, you are, I can demonstrate this, again, you know, and every time I see it, I'm going to point it out. And he's like, you know, God, this is like a really feminist response. And he's like, I'll do as many debates as I like. People enjoy watching my debates. There have been more debates on this subject than you could assume. So pick a different one to watch. I don't make recommendations based on nationality. And I say, you know, there are many debates on Israel-Palestine, but the ones held in Princeton tend to have the same features. Namely, it's basically an internal Jewish discussion between like a fire-breathing genocidal Jew and then someone like Dave Smith who thinks that they should maybe take their foot off the gas. Mm-hmm. And if he's pretending not to see that, and he's going to like call me a woman or say that, oh, what, you know, you're validating. Hope you feel seen. Are you 20? He's like, I'm not looking for your advice. Okay, great. So I'm just going to keep pointing out the wicked behavior you're perpetrating. And I'm going to tell everybody about this because it is what you're doing. Mm-hmm.
You know, I kind of hate to say it, but I do see your point. I guess the pushback I would give is that, at least in my experience, and I've talked to Dave a couple times, is that he, I think, engages these he engages them more as conversations rather than debates. And, you know, I know this is kind of semantic, but I don't think he wants to be hostile to these people. I think it's, he genuinely wants to change their mind. He genuinely thinks it's a conversation like we're having. But, you know, I think maybe to your point with these kind of people, I think
he calls them debates, right? So, that frankly is all the worse, right? If he's telling me, as I'm looking at the tweet right now on the other screen, he's like, I'll do as many debates as I like. So if he's going to call them debates to me and then privately hold the view that it's just a conversation, that is even all the more damning, right? Sure. Because it means that he views Dennis Prager and Bachi Ungar-Sargon and Josh Hammer and Douglas Murray and Laura Loomer as people to have conversations with. I have a conversation with you. I would never have a conversation with Dennis Prager, right? But Dave Smith will have a conversation with Dennis Prager, okay? What feature, what is causing this problem? What kinship, Dave? What friendship do you feel? What compassion do you feel? Are you just that nice a guy? Clearly not. You're willing to tell me to fuck off, right? You're willing to compare me to a woman, so it's something else.
Okay, I understand. No, I understand, and this is something that I've taken quite an intense look at over like the last year or so, and I don't know how you could say I'm not an anti-Israel guy. And you know what, he even kind of pointed this out on his podcast recently, and I do listen to his podcast all the time, but it's he's like, you know, Tim Pool and Matt Walsh kind of take this, you know, this pussyfooting stance, essentially, to not necessarily say exactly what he's saying, but kind of paraphrase it, where like he's like, oh, well, they just say, oh yeah, I mean, you know, I'm an isolationist, we shouldn't be funding it. It's like, okay, well, but like Israel's different. Like they lobby our politicians. They, you know, contribute to both sides of the aisle. They're the only country in the world that doesn't have to register with FARA. You know, they have speech laws here. So it's not like you could just take like a passive role and just say, ah, you know, it's the same as every other country. I don't care. No. They have a lot more of a vested interest in the U.S. and like to just not say anything about that, or even like, I don't know how you could just not be anti-Israel from, you know, our perspective. So I don't know, when he saw that, I'm like, I get it. I get the angle you're coming at, but like, how can you know? Even all the willing shit they
to
do?
That the rest of that tweet was like, you know, I got to hand it to Gad Saad. It's like, excuse me. Gad Saad is a self-confessed Mossad agent, a spy on Lebanon, right? Why? I would never hand it to Gad Saad. Why would you, right? This is the problem. Like, what is this? Either you feel this way or you feel that you should feel this way. All of these things are problematic. This refusal to take a properly hostile position to people who, again, are murderers. Again, in many cases, literally complicit, right? Whether because they are literally physically Israeli settlers, whether because they are on the payroll of the Israeli government as Mossad agents, whether because they are propagandists who can encourage people to become settlers because they do speaking tours, because they do everything they can, engage in legal activism against pro-Palestine activists. These are bad people who are like actively accessories to an ethnic mafia, your only business on a stage with these people to be to make sure that everybody in the audience is aware of the fact that the person that you're talking to is an evil person. And if you come to have a conversation with them, and God knows if Scott Horton were up there with them, you better believe that Bill Kristol would make every effort not to have a conversation with Scott Horton. He's like, no, I'm playing to win within the bounds of respecting Gene Epstein's, you know, platform, right? You know, Scott Horton talked about how during the debate, Bill Kristol said something under like, oh, well, I actually oppose this. And Scott Horton said, you know, after the debate, I tried to approach him to, you know, on that one line of agreement that we had to.
Yeah.
And as soon as he went to Bill Kristol said, I have nothing to say to you. What have you been doing? And he just left. So, okay, so you got to hand it to Bill Kristol. He knows how to address his enemies, right? You know,
yeah.
I got to hand it to Bill Kristol for not handing it to Scott Horton.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand where you're coming from. And
on the matter, you know, I wrote like a little quiz. Just, this is not for you because you're not posturing yourself as any kind of expert. This is just for everybody else, right? Here are a bunch of questions, 10 questions I came up with that can easily like acid test whether somebody is qualified to be on stage, much less on a college campus or anything else, to speak about Palestine-Israel issues. Question one, what is the difference between the Haganah, the Irgun, and Lehi? Question two, what is the difference between Yitzhak Rabin and Yitzhak Shamir? Question three, what is Deir Yassin? Question four, what city is Tel Aviv on top of? Question five, what precisely is an Israeli Arab? Question six, what does Hamas call itself? Question seven, why do Palestinians use watermelons? Question eight, in broad terms, what do areas A, B, and C mean? Just broad strokes. You don't need to get it exactly right. Question nine, why precisely is May 15th called Nakba Day? And then question 10, what is an intifada and why are there two of them? I think that if you cannot answer at least eight of those 10 questions, you are not qualified to have a debate about Israel. I don't expect everybody in the world to know about it, but these are, and if you go, anybody in the audience goes and looks these up, you'll see what I mean, that like this is like core knowledge that a person ought to have if they're going to stand up on a stage in front of an audience and be live streamed discussing these things. And what Dave Smith people tried to make it about was like Dave Smith not having a credential. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, you just got your PhD and you think it's because Dave Smith doesn't have a college degree. No, 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 because Jeremy Hammond doesn't have like an advanced degree. Literally, yeah. I mean, typically, all you need to do to get a PhD effectively is write a book, right? All dissertation is a book. So if I found somebody that had a PhD and hadn't written a book, I haven't written any books. I would never debate someone who wrote a book. Someone who writes a book and doesn't have a PhD is certainly on like a caliber above someone who hasn't written a book and doesn't have a PhD. So it's not about credentialism. It's about Dave Smith's provable lack of understanding. And anybody who doesn't believe me can just watch the Walter Block debate or watch any other debate Dave Smith has done. And you'll see that when people try to bring in specifics, Dave Smith retreats away from specifics. He has no specific knowledge. And he just says, I just think it's wrong to murder children. And listen, Dave Smith, I agree with you completely. It is wrong to murder children. I'm not going to sit here and argue with you on this. This moral impulse is good. Feel free to tweet about that moral impulse. Feel free to talk about it on your show with whoever you want. If you want to bring Josh Hammer onto your show and talk about why it's bad to murder children, if you want to bring Dennis Prager onto your show and talk about that, I will not say a single word to stop you. What I object to is when people that have serious academic platforms invite Dave Smith on. And I'm not mad at them for doing it because I know why they're doing it. I'm mad at Dave Smith for now consciously, not even refusing to see, whether he's refusing to see it or just a willing accomplice to it, taking part in this kabuki exercise. In the same way that if, you know, the blind mute guy that Jesus healed was like, I'm gonna, you know, where are you going? You're not going to believe it, guys. I'm about to go to Herod's temple right now. I'm going to go to Big Caiaphas. You know, it's going to be a big audience. I'm going to talk about Jesus. And it's like, hold on, what are you? It's like, well, I win each time. It's like, you win on what exactly? Well, these guys keep saying that Jesus was like a filthy heretic, you know, who deserves to die and that he's boiling an excrement right now. And every once in a while, I go to the temple and I say, listen, that's not fair. You might have made a mistake. Mm-hmm. Excuse me? Right. Every once in a while, I go to the temple and I say, listen, I don't think he ought to have been crucified. I think that was a bit too much for him. Hold on a second there, Chief. Mm-hmm. he miraculously healed your sight and speech, right? Are you not going up there and making the case that he's like God made flesh, he's a Messiah, that he's working miracles? Like, well, you know, listen, I'm just getting the best audience I can. It's like, if you're going up there and debating Caiaphas, and the only thing you're debating Caiaphas on is the ethics of like secret trials and crucifixions, then you are not really moving people in the Jesus direction, right? All you're doing is saying like you think that the Sadducees went too far. That's a problem. And especially if you point this out to the guy. I wish I remember the name of this of the blind mute that got king healed. I'm sure he has a name. All these characters have names. You know what I'm saying? They all have names. If like Simon Peter tells him this, or Paul tells him this, like, hey, next time the Pharisees invite you to, or the Sadducees invite you to a debate, can you please send, like, you know, I'm a temple trained rabbi. I'm Saul of Tarsus. You should send me to debate them, right? And I can give, it's like, I just don't think they want to have you on. Mm-hmm. Why? Why would they want you on and not me? Well, I have a bigger audience. I have a more impressive story. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this does kind of boil down to he's just the guy who already is acquainted with these people, and they recognize him as somebody who's well-informed on these topics. And, you know, I do think your point is valid.
But he's not well-informed on these topics, you see?
Okay, well, their perception is that he's well-informed on these topics, and the people who engage in debates with him, maybe, you know, it is true that they feel like they could swat him down easily, but at the same time, like I said, I think he's just the guy who's been up there a lot. And, you know, much to his credit, he has had, you know, Scott Horton on a whole bunch. He's had Dave DeCamp on the show, you know, twice, who's very, very well informed on this stuff. I did hear somebody
talk. It's good that he's had Scott Horton on his show.
Yeah.
Right. But the question is he urging Scott Horton to speak at Princeton, right? I would love it to the opposite. I would love Josh Hammer to be on the Dave Smith show and Scott Horton speak at Princeton, right? But we're in the bad situation where Scott Horton is on the Dave Smith show, do you see? And Dave Smith is at Princeton, right? We should be reversed on that situation.
Mm. I understand that. I do agree that, like, I would love to see these more specialized people in these kind of conversations. But I just think with the internet age, somebody like Dave Smith, once again, he's already omnipresent. He's been on Joe Rogan how many times? I just don't, you know.
Also questionable.
Yeah, but I think it's like Scott Horton doesn't have the same exposure that Dave has had for decades and decades. And I think Pete Quinones tweeted this out at one point that it's on purpose at this point that Joe Rogan wouldn't have Scott Horton on. And yeah. I have to agree with that because they both live in Texas. I think they're both in Austin or something like that. Scott's clearly well enough informed. Abby Martin has brought him up. I think Daryl Cooper brought him up. Dave has brought him up a whole bunch of times. Scott even is, if I remember correctly, Scott's Jewish too. So, like, why wouldn't he be brought on? Is it just because he's not well enough, and, you know, he's just not, doesn't have the clout? Like, I don't know.
This can't be the reason. There are people who are only known because they were on Joe Rogan, right? That can't possibly, like, I can't have you on my podcast because you're not famous enough. What are you even talking about? How many comedians, like, who would even know who Shane Gillis was if he wasn't on Joe Rogan, right? Who would know? Yeah. There's like a ton of political people that nobody would know anything about if they weren't on Joe Rogan. Mm-hmm. This totally fails. And he's like, I can't give you exposure because you don't have exposure. Is this Motown? What is this going on? Are we signing a record contract? Like, are you just an artist commission? Like, I'll pay you an exposure. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody pointed out Michael Malice. I would just take it as a whole separate.
Oh, but, yeah. Yeah.
Why does Michael Malice keep having Michael Jack Malice? Won't even have Scott Horton on. Right.
Yeah, he's had fucking Jack. He's had somebody fucking CIA ass.
I have a friend of mine who is compiling this. Michael Malice's guess. I mean, he's brought on Yarvin multiple times. I mean, Michael Malice really brings in, like, you know, he really scrapes the bottom of the tunnel to find these people.
Yes.
So there is no excusable reason for these people not to bring Scott Horton on and Dave Smith on, and Dave Smith not pointed out. Right.
Anarcho-Zionism. That's exactly what it is.
Anarcho-Zionism. Right. You know, if Dave Smith just says, like, listen, I'm just part of this internal discussion, then he can say so. I'm already saying so. And we're just two people that know what the other one is about. Right. But the fact that he's coming up with these excuses, well, Scott's not as famous as me. Like, you are getting more famous, though. Do you see? Right. Mm-hmm. You know, you could insist on it. You know, just imagine that. Like, how does anybody become famous? How does anybody, Jesus Christ, I'm trying to think like other like low tier academics, you know, people like Nathan Koffness was not famous and then he suddenly was, right? You know, people like Kremio. I mean, there's all sorts of people in the Thiel-Bapp sphere who were not famous until they were, right? The whole, it just collapsed on its own premise. It doesn't make any sense. Scott Horton is a grown-ass man. He's written 2, 3, 4 books. How many books has Scott Horton written? He's written Provoked, which I think you can see on the shelf behind me. He's written Fool's Errand. Provoked, Fool's Errand, Enough Already.
Yeah. How many books has he written? He had the Ron Paul one. The great
Ron Paul book. So Scott Horton's written 4 books. That's like 4 PhDs. I wouldn't want to debate Scott Horton. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't even know what degree Scott Horton has, right? Like,
no, he's just he always says just like an old, he's always like an old skateboarder from fucking Texas and was a cab driver back in the 90s. But you know, I mean, he's also interviewed all the experts in the world, but you know, he has a great depth of knowledge on all this stuff.
He has a syndicated radio show, or he had a national syndicated radio show. The idea that it's because he's not famous, no, it's because Scott Horton will win on a morally relevant issue, right? He's not, it's not going to be an internal discussion. You know, and even then we see that when he's actually in front of Bill Kristol's face, he tries to be nice, right? But certainly, you know, when he's debating Kathy Young, was that her
Yeah,
name?
That's what I was just going to say, Kathy
right?
Young.
You know, he stomps, right? And he stomps on morally relevant issues. Mm-hmm. Dave Smith, he wins on like these bunts, which is I think Crucifixion was too far. I think whipping him through the streets and making him carry the cross and crucifying him and stabbing me through the chest. I mean, come on, guys. Can't we admit that was a little bit much over religious pluralism? I'm not here to debate that, okay? I'm here to discuss a substantive claim about the Second Temple and the Hasmonean system.
Yeah. I definitely agree that there's something. I mean, I should probably just say it. It's part of the identity, right? Where it's a nepotistic network, basically, of people who, you know, have kinship and they look at each other as one and the same. So therefore, they feel like it's safer to have this conversation with somebody they share kinship with.
But they won't even have Max Blumenthal on, right? Max Blumenthal is also Jewish, right?
Yeah.
And they won't have him on either. So it goes, I mean, being Jewish is causally related. But I think, and sometimes Dave Smith likes to sort of dance in this Martin Bailey where it's like, you think I'm just on because I'm Jewish. Like, no. I think that your being Jewish is causing you to have some extra qualities, which is then why you're on. Max Blumenthal is also Jewish. Nonetheless, his Jewishness has not caused him to have these qualities, and so he's not on. Mm-hmm. You know, why has your Jewishness caused this and Max Blumenthal's hasn't? I don't know. Exercise, I mean, people are not a monolith, et cetera, right? You know, races are not formed out of the dirt like clones. But it's more like Dave Smith is bad, right? I don't know other way to put it. Like Dave Smith is a bad person who is also Jewish, right? Mm-hmm. But there are plenty of even better people who are Jewish. Gilad Atzmon is Jewish, and I would have him debate. That would be the best thing ever, honestly. Right? There are plenty of people, and Dave Smith is just not one of them because he doesn't know anything and he won't fight hard.
Okay. I agree that he doesn't fight as hard as I'd potentially like him to. I don't know that I would agree that he's a bad person because every single experience I've had with him has been positive.
I can't expect you to cross on that. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, sure. I agree that I would like to see him kind of the treatment that he gave Andrew Cuomo would be kind of the treatment that I'd like to see him give some of the pro-Israel people. And I mean, you know, that would be putting it subtly. So, yeah, man, I don't know. We're kind of getting around to the 90-minute mark, so maybe we should kind of tone up a little bit before we wrap it up. So I guess, like, who would be some people? I know we kind of mentioned some of them, but, like, who do you think would be some people that you would like to see in that position? And also, like, what gives you hope for their platforms?
Okay, so people that I think would be good to have in these debates. Grant Smith of Institute for Eastern Middle Eastern Policy, frankly, even John Mearsheimer, who else would be Gideon Levy, who's also Jewish and he writes for Haaretz, Richard Falk, even Norman Finkelstein, you know, who else? Even Ilan Pappe, Daniel McAdams, Ali Abunima, of course, Scott Horton, of course, Max Blumenthal, Aaron Mate. you know, I'm pretty sure half the people I named are also Jewish, right? But they but they know what they're talking about, and they're willing to fight hard. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what kind of gives you optimism for some of the people you just mentioned?
A proven record of, I mean, they've written, most of them have written books. a proven record of knowing what they're talking about, of being willing to stand on, again, morally relevant issues, to not play buddy-buddy with people with blood on their hands, to not accommodate people whose entire job is to sit here and justify murder and act as though that's like a normal thing that we need to accommodate or respect or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And it's always been kind of something weird when I see him say, I remember Jack Posobiec said something. He was like, "Love you, Jack." I'm like, that dude's like a CIA asset, clear as day. Like, how can you respect this person when everything about him is just so clearly fake? He's calling for bombing China, bombing Russia, and all this shit. Like, I know he doesn't have like any huge influence, but like, how can you say you like these people? And same deal with Charlie Kirk, who just like, one second say, "Oh yeah, you know, this Israel speech bill is really bad," and then like the next day he's like, "Oh, I smacked down a Talmudic expert to write quote unquote." Like, just when I see shit like that, I'm like, I don't respect these people. And like, especially someone like Charlie Kirk, who went on Patrick Bet-David and he was like, "Oh, how did this intelligence failure happen in Israel?" And then like literally the next day he's making a huge apology video and then just going on this huge Zionist rampage for months afterwards. I'm like, something's up here. Something is clearly going on. And like, we're supposed to be friendly with these people. Like, I don't see them as a conversation. Ally. Yeah.
Oh, Noor Erekat is another one that just came to mind. Mm-hmm. She is a professor. So that's another person. And so actually this is like a perfect segue since we're wrapping up. So for whoever it was that Charlie Kirk was debating, who I'm assuming that just from that, like, they went to a TPUSA thing and started, "Do you know the Talmud says that Jesus is boiling in poop or whatever?" And Charlie Kirk was able to run the table on that somehow. Okay,
yeah.
So I run a book club right now. We're going through Jeremy Hammond's book, Obstacle to Peace. The next book we're going to be going over is Laurent Guillaume's From Yahweh to Zion. And that will give you a much more solid foundation to do critical readings of even the Old Testament, not even the Talmud. Because again, the Talmud is just a critical Jewish reading of the Old Testament. So just to give you an example, there's a quote in the Talmud which talks about how even the best of the Gentiles should be killed. And it's like, well, that sounds like it's out of context. I'm about to give you the context. So it's Exodus. God has unleashed the plagues on the people of Egypt. He's destroyed the, you know, he's poisoned their water. What is it? He burned our crops, poisoned our water supply, and delivered a plague onto our houses, right? He did? Yes. Yes. And he's systematically destroying all the Egyptian gods. He's destroyed the sun. He's overpowering death and so on and so forth. And one of the plagues is he destroys all the livestock, right? So, let people go, move forward. The Hebrews are, you know, they're at the Red Sea. They don't know what they're going to do. Oh, there's Pharaoh. He's got his men. They're on their chariots. They're about to charge down. The sea's about to part. They're walking through. It's this big miracle. But the Talmud says, let's go back about saying, where did the Pharaoh get horses? If God killed all the livestock, where did those horses come from? And what they say is like, well, it's very simple. In that plague, God only killed the horses of those people who had opposed Israel. But that must mean all those horses belong to the people who didn't oppose Israel. And then the Pharaoh, being the Pharaoh, the sovereign, just appropriated everything they had and then used it on the Jews. Therefore, what this shows is that even the best of the Gentiles should also be killed.
Mm.
Do you see? So by obsessing over like these Talmud quotes, I mean, they're pretty spicy, but you're not going to go far doing that. Having the kind of contextual knowledge I just gave you, right? And now you'll be thinking about that, right? Because think about the implications that Ethos has for Gaza right now, right? Even like if you destroy all the livestock that the Pharaoh has, but every civilian resource can then just be mobilized for the state, that means you must destroy everything. What does that look like? What does that ethos look like in reality?
Looks like Gaza.
Right. So From Yahweh to Zion is a book we're going to be going through, which goes through the Old Testament, basically chapter by chapter, frankly, for the first for the first four chapters. It basically just goes through the Old Testament book by book, rather. It's highly recommended. Guillaume has good articles on the UNS review, which we'd also be reading. And we're probably going to start that in like mid-summer or so. And besides this, you should are we closing out? I was about to start listing off things.
Oh, yeah. Well, what did I want to say? Oh, yeah. I guess just kind of one thing to add on to that, and then you could go ahead and do your plugs. It's just like when I see these, I call them Juicebergs, the guys who just constantly say the Jews are behind everything and the Jews the answer for everything. Tom Budic experts. I'm always like, you guys aren't helping. Like, I literally threw up a tweet where I said, like, no foreigners should serve in America, right? Like, if you just came off the boat and then you're serving in Congress, like Ilhan Omar, like, you shouldn't be serving in foreign affairs. And someone was like, well, you know, great, now do Israel or something like that. Oh, like, what about Jews or something like that? And I'm like, yeah, if you look across my time, like, there's
plenty of in that case, Israel stuff.
Yeah.
If you've already shown, I mean, I would just say two things to that. So, three things. So first, since they're just saying, you know, do you also talk about X, and you do, then you have nothing to defend yourself against.
Yeah.
What I would say to anybody else who said that would be something on the order of, if I saw somebody that was talking about the Federal Reserve and saying something that was wrong, my instinct would never be to say, oh, you're like a Federal Reserve Spurg, and be like, we just can't talk about the Fed anymore, right? Yeah. If somebody said, listen, you know, the way the Fed works is that they just got a big money printer and they're just churning it out and they're handing it out to all their buddies. And I'm like, actually, excuse me, sir, that's actually not exactly how the scam works. It's this whole thing with like a bonds market. And since you're interested in this, let me clarify your understanding. You know what I mean? I wouldn't be like, we got to not have this conversation because something's being done about it. But oh, great. Fellow kindred spirit, you're in the know. Let me just clear you up so you don't get tripped up by someone else. And for the love of God, don't start, keep going. If you'd be invited to the Fed to have debates and not me, that would tell me that something's wrong with you. Yeah. And the other thing I would say to this is one advance of discussion. Oh, right. The reason that people spring out about this is because, like, imagine if you lived in a world where people didn't think that, like, cops arrested people, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they knew that police existed. They knew that they drove around in vehicles. They knew that they carried guns, and some were even willing to accept that they carried handcuffs, right? But they just didn't accept, like, so you're saying every cop's job is to arrest people? Who? People that commit crimes? Oh, but what about, and now I had to, like, every day of my life explain the, like, thousands of unexplained disappearances that happened in the city, right? If everybody had an otherwise complete world, except for the cop thing, and there were 1,000 disappearances, and they were on the news every day trying to discuss, like, I mean, where are all these disappearances coming, and they come back, and they're like, okay, it's the cops. It's the cops arresting people. It's like, but that guy didn't even commit a crime. Yes, sometimes they get people that don't commit crimes. Okay, but that guy did commit a crime. Yes, they get them too. Oh, but that guy's also a cop. Yes, on rare occasions, cops arrest cops, right? You know, cops arrest also, they arrest the rich and the poor. They arrest politicians. They arrest police officers. They arrest criminals. They arrest non-criminals. I mean, there's obviously a pattern to it, right? There's a general idea that cops should be, that even among cops, they should be arresting criminals, but they arrest all sorts of people. And especially we're talking about unexplained, it's in this world, unexplained disappearances in this world, that would be like 95% of disappearances in the city, right? In our world in which we know that cops arrest people, then yeah, we would say any remaining unexplained disappearances, if I started saying that's the cops too, you'd be like, hold on a second there, chief. Like, you can't say that, like, every time someone goes missing, it's the cops. Like, they have to go to jail. Like, I know the whole structure of how cops work. But if we live in a world in which we don't acknowledge this crucial thing that cops do, then you better believe you'd be tearing your beard out, right? Trying to explain to people.
I see what you did there.
You know, trying to explain to people that it's the cops. The cops arrest people. It's a whole procedure. Yeah. They have a whole book about doing it. They have multiple books about doing it. They talk about it amongst themselves. They practice techniques. They're in different departments in every city in the country, every country in the world. They have cops and they do this. And it would just become an overriding obsession. It's like if somebody were, like, obsessed with Congress, right? Imagine if everybody just didn't understand the Supreme Court or Congress, and they were like, you know, God, you know, sometimes it just seems like the state, you know, the government passes laws, and then some guy has a problem with it, and then it just feels like a week, you know, a year and a half later, it's just not the law anymore. It's like, yeah, the Supreme Court overruled it. There you go with that Supreme Court thing again. You know? Yeah, dude, it's everywhere. Like, what do I even say to that? Like, I didn't see any congressmen meet and make gay marriage legal. So why, you know, yesterday it was only legal like maybe like 13 states. Now it's legal in all 50. I can't explain this. Like, I can, right? It's the Supreme Court. So why does the Supreme Court sometimes rule in a liberal way and sometimes rule in a conservative way? You can't explain that. It's like some justices are conservative and some are liberal. Yeah, but sometimes a conservative, you know, allegedly the Supreme Court, by this logic, even when it's like a majority conservative Supreme Court, sometimes you get liberal decisions. Yeah, they just do that sometimes. That's just, you know, it's a whole internal thing. Yeah. It would become all consuming. right? If somebody, if especially if everybody on Earth had this massive Supreme Court shaped hole in their worldview, you would just be circling it like nonstop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand. I think my point is just basically like, if you are constantly in the replies of every single person, yeah, and even if it's like irrelevant, yeah, you get what I'm getting at. Just like,
yes, I can see in that case it's a problem.
Yeah, like, don't Jake Shields the topic, essentially. Like, I like Jake Shields, but sometimes it's just like, I think the CTE rattled your brain a little bit too much, bro. Like, let's take a little bit of a breather here. We don't always have to talk about the Jews as much as I like to talk about them as well. Let's, you know, there's other things to talk about. There's other causes for other things in the world. Just anytime somebody has just like one explanation for anything, it's like, okay, well, you're usually, you're missing things here. Well, like, I got,
again, it's only one explanation because we live in the world where we don't know the cops arrest people, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Because
so once people, it were acknowledged, like if I were talking to somebody that already knew all about what cops do, I wouldn't find it helpful to say it's the cops do. I mean, maybe if I knew something about cops, they did, like, oh, you don't know this. There's a whole internal affairs division. Let me tell you about that, right? That could be very exciting. You don't know there's a whole FBI. Like, it's like a super cop thing. It's like a separate, you know, there's actually a police union. But for the most part, if I were talking to somebody that already knew the general structure of police infrastructure, then I wouldn't want to talk to them about it, right? But frankly, that's the only reason to tell somebody to ease up on it, which is, I already know that cops arrest people. I already know about police unions and the FBI and internal affairs divisions. I already know about police academies. I've seen them in operation. I get how they work. I've
never walked.
Then you would tell that person, so ease up with me about, like, why don't you talk about the cops? I'm perfectly aware, right? Mm-hmm. And by the way, notice, we're not even talking about police corruption. I'm just talking about, like, the idea that a part of the cop's job is to put handcuffs on people, right, and put them in jail.
Right? or, you know, certain handlers make sure they say and sign on certain things.
Oh, yeah, you know, you have, every once in a while you have a politician, it's like, yeah, you know, some guy was causing trouble in my office, and then, you know, the police officer arrested them, and everybody was like, yo, did you see this congressman just said that a police officer in his office arrested somebody? Yo, this proves that cops arrest people. It's like, shit, man, I guess everybody was so fucking stupid they just didn't know that was true. What else would you do? You would have to tell everybody. You just have to hassle the entire world. It's like, look, I finally got a congressman. He said the cops arrested this guy in my office. So now when I tell you, okay, well, you've proven they've arrested that guy, but can you prove that the other, you know, 2,000 people that have vanished off the streets of New York today were also arrested by the police? It's like, were they also pissing on the street? Yeah. So then, yes, they were probably, it's actually quite predictable it's actually very predictable what will get you arrested by a cop. So actually, yes, you know, it would be overriding. You would never.
Yeah. Marcel, you are a very, very articulate guy. I really enjoyed this conversation. We're past the 90-minute mark, but, you know, I'm perfectly good with that. I really enjoyed this conversation today. So go ahead, do your plugs, let everybody know where they can find you, support you, check out your book club and all that good stuff.
Yes. So my Substack is right here on the screen, mgautreau.substack.com. That is Bias Confirmations, my Substack. On the top bar, it'll link to everything else, my Twitter, the book club, basically everything else you need to know. And actually, I don't need to plug anything but my Substack. It is also my link tree. So you can do it like that. You can follow me on Twitter at Anarchy in Black. You can. No, that's it. Substack, Twitter. That's it. Those are the only two places you really can ever talk to me. And join the book club.
Yeah, definitely go check that out. And after our conversation today, we'll definitely have to do another one sometime because I really, really enjoyed this. But
happy to be on.
Yeah, Marcel, if you don't have anything else, we'll close her out there.
Nope, that's it.
Cool. All right, everybody, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, take care.